Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Apples of Sodom by David Rowlands. Father O'Connor bent forward to clean his pipe in anticipation of that first after-dinner smoke. After banging it out against the bricks, he picked up an apple log, eyeing it thoughtfully. The land upon which his little church had recently been built was donated by a farming parishioner and had once been a small enclosed apple orchard. With neglect, however, its fruit had become crabby, its trees twisted and wild. The good father loved trees and regretted the necessity of grubbing up even so spoiled an orchard, but there was no denying the transient benefit to us. Apple makes the best of firewoods. At this time, his store still held a few branches against winter, and so it was that an excellent fire was blazing in the red brick hearth, the seeing of the flames and crackling of devoured timber providing a background to our conversation. That log puts you in mind of something I said, a statement rather than question. Indeed, it does, he sighed a little, as he replaced the log and began to dip his fingers into a shabby old tobacco pouch. The experience was one of the oddest, and in many ways the most incredible, of my ministry. Yet there were also overtones of sardonic humor about it from a Catholic viewpoint. Well, I said, you must tell me about it now, Father. I am all attention. Instead of beginning, he lit his pipe and eased the slippers off his feet before swinging his cassock leg up to rest on the fender. What do you know of vampires? He asked, seemingly going off at a tangent between preliminary puffs. I suppose I know the usual mumbo-jumbo about how allegedly to lay them with garlic and steak, I answered. But are you telling me, Father, that you actually encountered one of these creatures? He smiled and made no direct reply. It was at my very first parish charge, he said, a little village in Berkshire. I was fortunate in that the vicar of the Anglican community was as young as myself, as inexperienced and as inclined to be friendly. His parishioners resented him as an upstart who had replaced their well-loved old vicar of decades. And by the time I arrived, poor Bane, that was his name, had fallen foul of most of their cherished prejudices and customs. His friendship for me was the last straw and was seen by his parochial church council to be a direct path to Rome. He chuckled reminiscently. Time heals all. He has now been the vicar for over 30 years, and any attempt to replace him would doubtless be resisted most strongly. We still correspond from time to time. Anyway, I had not been long about my duties and was, in fact, in the act of returning home to breakfast after early mass one delightful summer morning when I heard my name called and turned to see Bane sprinting after me in breathless haste. He accompanied me back to my lodgings. Waiting for us there was a sallow, gypsyish young fellow whom he introduced as Len James. It transpired that this fellow James was employed to keep the churchyard tidy. My splendid housekeeper rose to the occasion and produced extra coffee and breakfast. Mr. James, at least, ate his as though he hadn't eaten for a fortnight. When we had finished, he smoked a cigarette and, at Bane's prodding, began a tale which I will precise. I could not for the life of me mimic his ramblings and often irrelevant discourse in Berkshire dialect. Working in the north corner of the churchyard, he had hung his coat on a low bough of a small stunted crab tree that grew where he was scything a luxuriant growth of grass. From time to time he repaired there for a swig of cold tea from a bottle in his pocket, and at lunchtime the shade was so inviting that he took his scythe and whetstone across to sharpen there while he munched his midday bait. Chewing away, he set to alternately abrading the scythe's edge and testing it with his thumb. Whether due to the bread and cheese and sunshine, or whether his labors had tired him, he fell into a brown study. He yawned and stretched out, his foot running idly through the rank grass met an obstacle and stopped. Interested, he pulled and scraped away the turf to reveal the corner of an old slate slab. So, he'd been sitting beside someone's grave, had he? What an odd place to bury them. He continued scraping away the thick grass roots and soon had a sizable flat slab exposed. The apple tree apparently grew out of the top of the grave, emerging from under the edge of the covering slab, obviously taking the easiest way out. There was a faint inscription, but time and normal erosion had all but defaced it. My young Anglican friend interjected here that he had taken a pencil rubbing of the faint inscription and pulled a crumpled paper from his pocket. It appeared to be Sepulcher non mover, and below that, Noli prodere, and the date, 1747, which we took to be part of an injunction against mowing the burial plate of someone interred in 1747. I was not, and am not, sure why it should be given in Latin, except perhaps simply to warn the educated and not inspire the perverse yokel to investigate further. Anyway, to get back to James' narrative, just as he was rising to get back to his labors, his eyes caught sight of a billet of wood. To insert this under the edge of the slab was a moment's work. He moved it slightly, but no more, nor could all his efforts avail further. Shrugging in annoyance, he picked up his scythe and turned back to the grass, to become aware of a short, squat figure watching him from beneath the tree. For an instant, he thought it was a dense cloud of the little gnats that had been pestering him, drawn to his perspiration. Then he thought it was a heat haze mirage. Whatever it was, its scrutiny had the effect of immobilizing him while it drew nearer. His outstanding impression was of a mass of hair grown long that hung about a grayish body and spread about on the ground like a train. As it advanced, the limbs parting the hair seemed very bony and yellowish. Of face or physiognomy, there was no trace. But two eyes gleamed through the hair and reflected a reddish light. Backed against a stone monument and unable to give away, James shuddered as a thin, hairy limb parted the hair to reveal prominent yellow rabbit-like teeth overfilling a red mouth. The thing was level with him. He was crouching, and a wave of peculiarly earthy breath, redolent of mold, came over him, and he screwed his eyes shut, palpitating in horror. Nothing further happened, and with a sinking feeling, he opened his eyes and saw nothing. She, for so he reckoned the stunted figure, was gone, but a cloud of gnats hovered for a moment beneath the apple tree and then was gone also. James shook himself hard, aware that chilly drops of sweat were coursing down his back, and went out into the sunshine. Returning from the swan that night, he went to bed and dreamed of her as a young and comely woman. They had walked through the meadows below the church, detoured through a copse to avoid the river, and had crossed the lawns of a stately orange brick mansion that lay among the concealing poplars. Bain interrupted again here to say that this sounded like the old manor house, a painting of which hung in the vicarage. The present, much altered building dated from about the mid-18th century. James resumed the narrative of his dream. They had climbed to a room with a balcony that overlooked the river, the fields, and the churchyard, its tombstones like pebbles on a green beach. His companion had shaken her fist and howled curses toward the church. The scene hazed over like a heat mirage, and he was lying back, gazing up at an ornamental ceiling whereon nymphs and centaurs besported with mythological abandonment. He woke at dawn in his own bed. Shivering and exhausted, he was just conscious of something that slipped under the bedroom window sash. Getting up was an effort. His work that day seemed unusually tiring, and Bain had commented on his lethargy, telling him not to overdo it in the sun. He had been particularly plagued by gnats, which persisted around him despite flailing arms and rubbed crushed arrow over his face and arms to repel them. Bain emerged from the church an hour or so later to find James resting beneath the tree, and going across was much intrigued to see the uncovered slab and took the rubbing of the faint inscription. However, parochial business called him away for most of the day. Returning to the churchyard, just before tea, he again saw James resting beneath the tree in an old coat or sack propped on a spade, partly obscuring him from view. On approaching closer, though, He saw that he had been mistaken. There was no coat, or spade, come to that, only a dancing cloud of little flies, and James was lying asleep, breathing adenoidally, his head against the stem of the apple tree. He shook him awake and told him to cease work for the day. So James plod off home and again that night dreamed. This time he was in the churchyard and saw her from the roots of the tree to meet him. He woke to find himself in the place of his dream, lying beneath the apple tree, his clothes soaked with dew and a faint mist drifting over the ground. He was so weak that he could hardly move, and crawling to the lych gate, he collapsed. Here Bane found him at first light, apparently dreaming, writhing and twitching like a dog in sleep. On hearing his somewhat incoherent story, Bane helped him over to the vicarage and phoned the doctor, who, however, was out on an all-night case. He then thought of me and sent James to wait at my house while he came to meet me from early mass. To eliminate the obvious, I examined Mr. James' neck for the legendary marks, but found nothing. For all his weakness, if this was a vampire, then it was a lamprey of the life force rather than a carnal sucker of blood. However, a number of things had to be done. I bade Mr. James rest on my sofa and stay all day if I did not return. Bane I dispatched to his parish records to check on the occupancy of that manor house and its relation to the date 1747 on the slab. Moreover, I wanted a canvas tent to screen the slab from inquisitive eyes. After making preparations to absent myself for several hours, I hastened to the vicarage. My young friend had dug out the parish registers and a rector's diurnal from the old chest and was making notes. There could be no mistaking the relevant entries. A scholarly longhand was a reference to the removal of Lady Alice Beauregard from the family vault to a spot in the north churchyard that could only be the present grave. There were references forward to 1752 in the rector's journal and back to 1584. Unhappily, the latter was no longer in existence, the extant register beginning at 1690 or thereabout. But the former was simply to a note that Henry Goodenough, sexton, did show me a sapling or treelet growing out of the Lady Alice's tomb. I suppose it would be apple, which same he did confirm, and a further note to the effect in 1770 that the by then substantial tree was known as the cursing tree. The learned rector had a parallel to draw with the apple tree of Sodom and a lesson to revive that intis said by my people that its fruits would taste sour to them of descent, but sweet withal to those of popish ways. He would seem to have deemed it necessary to preach a strong sermon. He wrote admonition against those in his parish who believe that on the anniversary of the lady's interment, they could curse their neighbors by placing a token on the tree boughs. There being no more to learn from the records and rector's journal, we adjourned to the churchyard where a canopy had been fixed round the spot beneath the tree to see if Lady Alice was still at home. The sexton gave a start of surprise at seeing me with his priest and fixed a resigned look on poor Bane. Mr. James' efforts had certainly moved the slab and left a slight gap. Together, we three levered the crowbar provided by the sexton and moved the slab, whereupon a cloud of gnats flew out and away into the air. The tree roots, so revealed, grew sturdily in the soil, bent almost at right angles to emerge from beneath a slab. The sexton carefully excavated the hole further to reveal a stone coffin of great age, such as were made in the 13th century, and stockpiled by some families for use for future generations. The lid had been forced up by the tree, which clearly grew as an offshoot from some long-dead stake, just as a briar sometimes shoots from a cultivated rose stump. The coffin itself was full of earth, which would need careful sieving to determine bones or other relicta. I had learned enough. However, the lady had been staked in earth on her removal from the family mausoleum in 1747, no doubt to keep her quiet. Mr. James' discovery of the newer grave and shifting of the slab had evidently wound up her mechanism, as it were. He provided her with vitality, if so unsuitable a word could be used. What to do about it? That was the question. I had already decided against any appeal to my diocese, a worthy director, but lacking imagination and not likely to countenance our ecumenical approach. A hail from the lych gate announced that my lift to the station had arrived and I took leave of Bain for the time being. Luckily, the journey to Oxford was reasonably easy in those days and involved no change of train. I had first met Con McAllister at Cambridge. He was a born mystic of undoubtedly queer gifts and on a mental plane far removed, thank heaven, from my own. He was extremely attractive to women and missed none of the opportunities that came his way. Inevitably, his clarity of intellect suffered and degeneration set in. We had remained friends since I discounted most of the scandal I had heard about him, though I suspect his liking for me was more in the nature of cynical amusement. It was typical of the man that he had made Cambridge too hot for him and taken himself to Oxford, where I now found him, affectedly pleased to see me. He was at least interested in my problem, and there and then telephoned an introduction for me through to another erudite friend, whither I then repaired. The Reverend Samuel Montague proved to be a strange and effeminate bibliophile, who spent most of his waking hours in the Bodleian. In conversation, it transpired that he had written the Vatican's Libra Eroticus on demonology and the black art. I was glad to have this opportunity of meeting such an arcane and odd character, yet uneasy too. There was something repellent about him. I was received in a book-lined study, thousand upon thousand of books, the collection of a lifetime, he told me, mostly of the strange and bizarre, but with a good sprinkling of long-forgotten dramatists. He saw to it that even a modest bibliophile like myself expanded in the presence of such a fascinating authority. Had the matter back home not been so pressing, I could have stayed all day, drinking his sherry and looking over his incredible files of persecution data that made my Cambridge thesis look decidedly anemic. On hearing my praises of Mr. James Tale and subsequent researches, he went at once to a row of calf-bound notebooks like folios. After a moment's pause, he selected a volume and thumbed delicately through the pages. Ah, he smiled. Here we are. Lady Alice Beauregard. Yes, yes. And he handed me the book with a quizzical look. To my surprise, it was written by hand, in Latin. Now, at last, I had cause to thank the strictness of the Christian Brothers Seminary in Tralee. I took the book from Mr. Montague and began to read, with only an occasional pause. Maiores Henry Beauregardi, portamontem triumphum orti sunt, in sexto decimo saculo emerium suffragati sunt e coronantem ordinavant. That is to say, the line of Henry Beauregard dates back to the Norman conquest. In the 16th century, they were strongly pro-Mary and took a leading part at her coronation. The wife Alice was widely believed to be the influence in the family, and her portrait, the original of which has not survived the fire of 1584, allegedly showed her to be a stern, hard-faced woman. Henry died in 1562 and was buried in the family crypt beneath the church. Alice, who died in 1584, had been implicated as instigator of a number of Catholic plots against Elizabeth. She committed suicide when arrest was imminent and died unrepentant, unabsolved, and, it was alleged by servants, with bitter curses and dire threats. Local legend had it that her hand from the grave fired the house later that same year, 2 days after the Desmonds, to whom Elizabeth granted the house and estate in perpetuity, took possession. 9 lives were lost, and the line of Desmond all but perished, the property passing to a cadet branch. Parish records show that the old lady was still a force to reckon with in the parish, and caused much disturbance during the Reformed services, with noise and commotion from the crypt. But these died out around 1680. There are further records of disturbances with a new Desmond in the parish, who had the shell of the old manor pulled down in 1747. It is alleged at that time that she appeared in dreams to the family, threatening their sleeping hours and terrifying congregations with noises from the vault. Desmond had appointed to the living a rector of great force and character, who investigated the matter thoroughly. Entering the crypt, he found stone coffins thrown about or tumbled off their niche. The cadaver of the old dame herself was well preserved, albeit shriveled and desiccated, and she hung half out of her open coffin. Her hair had continued to grow and was of prodigious length. This they cut off with consecrated shears and burned, believing that much of her malicious power resided therein. In accordance with prevailing belief, the crypt was sealed up and she and her coffin removed to ground on the north side of the church, and her body pyred with a good and sound staff of apple, she being then confined beneath a proper slab duly blessed. I stopped reading. The Reverend Montague pushed his glasses up to his forehead with an odd little smile as he recovered the book from me. "Now," he said, "it would seem that you have a nice little problem, Father. The lady is not going to stay quiet so long as that slab can be moved, obviously. I don't know what she is after, but I suggest so staunch a Catholic is not going to be appeased by any watered-down Anglican ritual. That rector of 1747 was a clever man, but not quite imaginative enough, though at that he seems to have kept her quiet for some 200 years. He chuckled. "My suggestion is that you, Father, give her absolution. I think she might rest then. Do let me know what transpires so that I can keep my notes up to date." This then gave me a fine problem in diplomacy, continued Father O'Connor. Before I left Reverend Montague, he took me to visit his private chapel downstairs, and my doubts of his sanctity as a priest disappeared in that tranquil haven. Only later did I learn from the cynical McAllister that next door was another room, the exact antithesis of the chapel, and which served for more diabolical ceremonials. What an enigma these two brilliant men were. I arrived back, tired and travel-stained, to find that James had felt better and had gone home. My housekeeper thought someone had called for him. I dropped into the vicarage, doubtless to the further scandalization of the village, and told Bain what I had discovered from Reverend Montague. He was all attention and most grateful, but I was not surprised that even this insouciant upholder of the Trinity Nine Articles was disturbed at the thought of my giving absolution, whereas I was sure, on reflection, that Reverend Montague was right, however lenient my views on the validity of Anglican orders might be. To this stern old revenant from the 16th century, there would be no question but that the rights of priesthood rested solely with the elder church. We might have debated the matter academically for the rest of our lives had not Bain been summoned to the door. It was James' old mother. He had not been home since morning. It was now quite late, and she was worried. We both guessed, of course, where we should look for him. Reassuring his mother as best we could, we sped across to the churchyard in the dusk. A whirligig of bats were circling round the massive pile of the four-square Norman tower. On the north side, our tent was still in place, and a dark hump was lying before it. As we arrived at the grave, we could see that it was James, barely conscious and hardly breathing. Bain bent to tend him, and I looked from them to see the woman of our quest. As James had said, at first glance she was simply a mass of hair with a suggestion of limbs. I showed her my crucifix whereupon the snarl, which had displayed those hideous rabbit teeth, through the hair changed to a softer expression. She reached out a thin arm, and I all but recoiled in revulsion at its texture, but gave her the rosary. The act of reaching out parted the hair from her chest and revealed a ragged wound, black and gaping against a cerecloth. Seeing quickly that Bain was absorbed in trying to resuscitate James, I said swiftly, "May the Lord be in your heart and on your lips, that you may truly confess your sins." She knelt, the hair spreading out like a pool around her. No sound came to me, though I saw her lips move. She was substantial enough for me to feel the slight pressure of her touch upon the chain of my cross. I spoke briefly of the coming together of the churches in Christ, glad that our respective superiors were not there to interject, and concluded with the absolution, "Ego te absolvo in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen." With the words, "Resequat in pace," her form seemed to slide into the ground, and the prone James began to stir. Bain and I helped him back to his mother's house, and I must say, I fell all in. It had been quite a day. James was troubled no more, but I think he gave up working in churchyards. Bain and I talked long that night. Next day, at my suggestion, he read the committal over the grave, and we replaced the slab, having got the sexton to sink the entire grave as much lower as the tree roots would allow, which wasn't much. However, it was possible to turf over the top, and we hope that would take care of the Lady Alice for the future. Leaving the sexton to place the turfs, we walked off down the path. As we emerged beneath the apple tree, I plucked two of the tiny fruits and handed one to Bane. He bit his and winced. Spitting out the fragments, I swallowed mine with apparent enjoyment. "Quite tasty," I said. He gave me a sharp look. "Come, father," he said, "you are pulling my leg." I returned the smile. "My dear Bane, you wouldn't have me disappoint an old lady, would you? Possibly I deserve the stomach ache I suffered that night." A graven image by David Rowlands. For several years after the war, my family used to travel by car to Clacton or Jaywick for our annual fortnight's holiday. Squeezed into the beloved old Austin 10, her black coachwork polished for the occasion and her seats redolent of leather oil, I would sit on my grandfather's knee in the front, beside my father who was driving. My mother, grandmother, and in later years two younger sisters occupied the rear of the 100-mile journey. Roads were generally much quieter then, of course, and speeds more leisurely. At exactly the halfway point, we would turn onto the tarmac-veneered Roman road, which sped straight as an arrow through the market town of Abbott's Hot Pot from the Essex coast. Parallel with it, a field's distance away, was the little branch line railway, which the Great Eastern ran from Abbott's Hot Pot to Great Minnow and on to Estuary. From our Roman highway, intriguing little roads struck off at right angles to explore small hamlets and earthworks steeped in feudal tradition. They crossed a single line of railway by stout red brick bridges, the arches of which were much blackened by the smoke of innumerable trains. In one place, by a level crossing with attendant keeper's cottage built in a style unique to the Great Eastern Railway. The holidays, with their memories of beaches and rented bungalows, sandcastles, ice creams, and sand everywhere, and one's toes, clothes, and victuals, are a happy recollection. But more important to me than the holiday itself was the timing of our arrival at this level crossing, close by Rodding's Lodge Station. Here the car was parked while we stretched our legs, involving a walk down to the crossing while the ladies got busy unpacking thermos flasks and sandwiches. If Dad had timed it correctly, and he invariably did, then there were but a few minutes to wait for the morning train to arrive at the station. Then old Bob, the crossing keeper, whom we got to know well, would amble out to shut the gates across the road. He would nod to us, "Back again then?" And if the wind was right, we would hear the peep of the guard's whistle, a louder toot from the engine, and then the approaching shoves of his exhaust. Once the chunky little tank engine, an F5 for the technically minded, had passed with its ragtag and bobtail of coaches, old Bob would reopen the gates to let across any vehicles that had accumulated. Then he and my grandfather would chat about gardening until we thought the sandwiches would be unpacked and ready for us. Old Bob had a wonderful garden that stretched between the single line and a siding into a small brickworks, a few flowers and regimental ranks, but mostly a wondrous display of vegetables, particularly runner beans. Granddad was no mean gardener, but he gave old Bob best for runners. "Ah, Bob," would rumble knowingly, and I'm not going to try and transcribe his slow Essex drawl. "It's the vibration of the train, see? That's what you haven't got." One year, it must have been 1947 or 48, old Bob was up a ladder when we arrived, perched in front of the curiously pointed upper window and painting the fascia boards round the gable. The ground plan of the cottage would be L-shaped with boarded walls, painted off-white or cream, a tall red brick chimney stacked at the side, and with fascias, windowsills, and water butt of emerald green. Bearing a battered old kettle of paint, Bob clambered down to my dad, who knew about such things. "Told me to paint it maroon, they did," he complained. "Bloomin' civil servants. Well, we survived the liner, and now we'll survive British Railways, too. Great Eastern we are, and Great Eastern we shall stay." Sadly, though, the bureaucrats wielded powers greater than old Bob knew. With a post-war increase in road transport, railway systems everywhere had begun the long, hard fight for survival. Within 4 years, Great Minnow had lost its passenger service, with only a daily goods train threading the trails that quickly began to disappear among the encroaching weeds and grass. In less than a decade, all traffic had ceased. The staff were withdrawn, the track lifted for scrap, and the stations demolished or sold for private dwellings. However, I am getting ahead of my story. It so happened that our annual holiday were not the only times we saw old Bob, for each year we made 3 or 4 additional visits to the nearby big house called Rodding's, where the owner, Colonel Rodding, had an extensive model railway laid out in his garden. My father spent what little spare time he had in building rolling stock, i.e. carriages and wagons, for the colonel, on commission, and whenever an item was finished and ready for delivery, he and I would set out for Rodding's, where we had an open invitation to the weekly running sessions. These were invariably a hard-won Saturday off for my father, since he was expected to work 6 days, the 40-hour week being then but a pipe dream. Often we would arrive to find other people present, each with trains of their own to run, but I preferred it when there was just Dad, the Colonel, and me. How it came about that I was allowed to attend, I don't know, for I have since been assured that the Colonel had a strict no-children rule. But he was kindness itself to me, and he had given me a big clockwork locomotive of my own, similar to the F5 tanks that plied the Minnow Branch. This I was allowed to take home and bring back to run on the tracks whenever we visited Rodding's. We were always given a nice lunch, served by a real butler in a black coat, either on the lawn if the weather was fine, or indoors in the railway room, which was a fascinating workshop where the colonel had the terminus of his railway and kept his model trains. Here his mechanic, a gnome-like little man called Fred, built the engines, overhauled them, and did other engineering jobs for the estate, such as repairing lawnmowers, tractors, or cars. Fred would not build rolling stock, though, hence my father's role. After lunch, the running would start in earnest. I was confined to the branch line with my clockwork engine and some wagons, but I didn't mind, for it wound through beds of dwarf conifers and flowers in fascinating manner. True, it had no magnificent tubular bridge by which to cross the Goldfish Lake, on which a steamship plied as a ferry, or a viaduct across which to straddle the close-cut lawns, as had the mainline expresses, but it had a short tunnel and pleasant terminus by the herb gardens. It is tempting to enlarge on some of my adventures operating this branch line, particularly when toads occupied the tunnel, but my story will never be told if I do. When I was tired of the branch line, I would bring my train into the bay platform of the junction, among the azaleas near the tennis courts, and watch the model expresses thunder by, for although the miniature rails were only 1 3/4 inches apart, the majority of the colonel's engines were operated by steam, and very impressive they were too. Fred had built many of them to his own design, though in the form of recognizable prototypes, and they burned either methylated spirits or more fearsomely pressurized paraffin. Very occasionally something would go wrong and a train would derail at speed. Then there would be a hectic scene of men dancing about, wringing scalded fingers as they tried to right an overturned locomotive that spread pools of blazing fuel. Occasionally stock would be damaged in such a melee, and then Dad would carry a repair job home with him that night. One of the colonel's little fads was that he liked to people his trains with model figures. This was easy for the coaches and stations and for the few engines which ran by clockwork or by electricity, but in the case of the live steamers, the ubiquitous flame and heat were too intense for commercial figures of bakelite or soft alloy to survive. My dad had cogitated this problem for some time, and I had recently seen him, indeed, as I affectionately remember him best, bent over his work table, with a cigarette smoldering in the corner of his mouth while he plied a fiercely smoking soldering iron from the gas ring to the framework of a figure he was building up. Dad, being the sort of man he was, had made an elaborate and reasonably correct skeleton from wire and bits of a dismembered umbrella frame. Over this he then built up a body of fire clay and kilned it in my long-suffering mother's oven. A few nights before we were due to go to Rodding's, with a new coach, he began to paint the figure, and it at last took on the semblance of humanity. To my surprise, it was clearly old Bob, but dressed in dungaree-type overalls. "I thought we'd promote him to top-link driver," my dad explained in one of his jocular moods. This particular visit was the occasion on which we'd found Bob, painting his house in defiance of authority from his kettle to illicit green. To the colonel's delight, the miniature Bob stood up well to an afternoon of heat and burning in the engine cab. The light blue paint of his overalls had blackened, and the features charred a little, but I remained a recognizable figure. Personally, I found it rather horrible after its ordeal by fire, and I think my dad did too, for he never took so much trouble over the few more drivers and firemen he fashioned. On subsequent visits, it became clear that the model of old Bob was becoming exceedingly brittle, just as the original was becoming arthritic. In fact, as the colonel handled the miniature one afternoon, it crumbled badly, leaving an exceedingly macabre handful, a figurine with wiry bones sticking out from crumbling limbs. The colonel laughed, however, and said, "Oh, well, we'd better give him a decent burial, I suppose," and vanished into his workshop. He returned with a narrow, oblong cigar box into which the figure just fitted. "Snug fit," he grinned at me through his mustache, and producing a little trowel, he dug a small hole in the herbaceous border beside the branch line. My father was a somewhat strict Methodist, and I could see that this black jest was little to his liking. However, he said nothing, and the colonel buried the box, reciting the while, "Ashes to ashes, dust to dust," and concluding jocularly to me, "Oh, well, maybe you'll have a ghostly ganger walking the branch line on moonlight nights, huh?" On our way home that day, we noticed a small knot of people as we came up to the crossing house. I guess my father would stop, and I craned my neck and flapped my ears out of the window as he got out and spoke to one of the men, a porter from the station, who was now the sole staff there. "What's up, Williams?" "It's old Bob, I'm afraid, sir. He had a fit or heart attack or something while cooking his meal and fell across the gas stove. He's dead, and most of his face is burned away." My father made no comment to me about what he had heard. In any case, he was an unimaginative man, ready to quell any fancies in me. So we had a singularly silent drive home. No successor to old Bob was appointed, and the house fell empty. The branch line was vegetating. The daily goods train had given way to irregular working for the brickworks, and Yarrow choked the track. Old Bob's veggies and flowers reseated themselves bravely, but made little headway untended, and soon there was only a cluster of marigolds defiantly blazing away among the chickweed and coos grass. We guessed it had become the fireman's job to jump down and open the crossing gates for his train, which left only a sign of bruised herbage to mark its passing. Before long, the authorities closed the line completely and the track was lifted. Since the line had taken right of way across the colonel's land, he was interested to repurchase it. This he achieved in due course, becoming possessor not only of the derelict station building, fast vanishing in a tangle of briars, but also of the crossing keeper's house. With statutory powers in his pocket to make a link road to his carriage sweep from the site of the old crossing and over an ancient mound, it's wonderful what a local JP can achieve. He decided to use the crossing house as a lodge or gatehouse and had it completely refurbished. I was pleased to learn that it was repainted in the green and cream and felt that old Bob would have approved. Much of this information I picked up secondhand via my parents' letters, for I was away at school. It was thus I became aware of the problems that the colonel was having in getting anyone to live there. This news via my mother had perforce to originate with my dad and, needless to say, was censored in accordance with what he thought was suitable for us to know. He was not going to encourage weakness of mind by repeating foolish country folklore. Even so, enough filtered through for me to gather that whatever would-be tenants might see or hear, they were oppressed in mind and never stayed for more than 2 or 3 days. It was on one of my rare school holiday visits to Roddings that I actually heard the colonel talking to Dad about the business. They were repairing track behind the shrubbery, unaware that I was crouched down, tending a branch train at the time, though I was actually more interested in the colonel's daughter, Paula, who was receiving coaching at the tennis nets. "I'm telling you, Stand," he said indignantly. "I saw it myself, darn it. There was this shadow on the wall, which I thought was mine. So it was, but the position of the lamp was wrong. I soon realized that there was a sort of glow behind me, and as I turned, I saw a figure." His voice tautened. "And instead of a face, there was a tongue of bluish flame. It wasn't just me that saw it. Gunby, the keeper, who had come with me, gave a yell and loosed off both barrels of his shotgun. Only just missed spraying me with shot, the idiot. Did no end of damage, too. We both cleared out pretty quick, I can tell you." His narrative ran down like a deflating balloon, as my father sniffed skeptically and disapprovingly. "You are an ungodly fellow, Alistair," he said, sternly to my amazement. It must have been years since anyone had spoken so to the colonel. "I have no doubt that you were overexcited. Why, man, you were out looking for boggles, so of course you saw one, or thought you did. Well, just to show you that the man of faith is not to be fooled by such illusions, If you can fix it with my directors, I'll undertake to live and work in your cottage for a week. How's that? The offer must have been accepted, and the colonel duly pulled such strings as were necessary, for within a week or so my mother and I were seeing my father off from home with a carload of ledgers. He had refused our company. We would get in the way of his work, and he didn't want any of our fancies complicating matters. Poetic justice would seem to require that he should have returned after one night, frightened out of his wits, but this was not the case. He was considerate of our anxiety, however, and duly phoned from Roddings each morning after a night at the cottage. He had dealt quickly with the ledgers and was filling in time by making some wagons for the colonel, with tools borrowed from Fred. He had nothing to report other than that he had formed a poor opinion of the Methodist preacher on the Minnow Circuit. After a week of this, he and the colonel agreed on a further week's trial, for the colonel himself flatly refused to spend any time in the cottage. Accordingly, Dad wanted me to go down and spend the time with him. I was not consulted in the matter. I never was. But I think I would have wanted to go anyway, if only out of sheer curiosity and confidence in my father's judgment. He had seen nothing, ergo, there could be nothing to see. On alighting from the old AMT 458, as the Austin was called, at the cottage I noted a chalk notice. Sunny sightings propped against the doorpost, outward and visible evidence of my dad's quirky humor. On entering, however, I became instantly uneasy and oppressed. The cottage was not hostile, but sullen and, well, shall we say, waiting? Clearly it did not affect my father, for whistling, he set about unpacking his supplies from Roddings and sorting us out a lunch from among them. I did not care to explore the cottage somehow. It would have been resented, I think. So, hoping that there might still be a few raspberries surviving in old Bob's patch, I wandered off up the old track bed, alongside which lay a few abandoned and uprooted sleepers. There was still a short length of weed-choked rail into the brickworks, and a few derelict wagons owned by the company stood there, deprived of any purpose by the fleet of Fodden lorries, a couple of which I could see in the distance. There were no raspberries, so I walked up to the old station for blackberries, since it now resembled Br'er Rabbit's briar thicket. I managed to scale the overgrown platform edge and stepped gingerly through the brambles along the building. The roof and awning sagged ominously, given over to starlings, a few swallows in season and decay. A signboard in dark blue paint, still remarkably fresh, protruded above the jungle announcing Roddings Lodge Halt in white letters. I pushed at the waiting room door, which had stuck and swollen with the damp. It gave suddenly and precipitated me forward into the room, dislodging a heap of old bird's nest and guano, which disintegrated on my head and set me sneezing. Where windows were open or broken, briar and wisteria were pushing their way inside, while corners where dust had gathered or been blown showed trails of rodent activity. A spider regarded me balefully from a grayish tangle of webbings across the clock, which I was surprised to see still above the ticket hatch. The clock had stopped at 2:23, the time of a former train. It was a nice touch. I looked inevitably at my wristwatch, 2:20, and walked back outside into the sun. Oh well, I thought, old Bob would be pottering close to the gates in a minute or two, and I stood on the platform a moment, enjoying the thought of ghostly trains pushing through the undergrowth. I looked down line to the former crossing and started for a moment as a figure peered from the house. But it was only Dad hailing me for our belated lunch. He was not best pleased at the state I was in. "You'd better wash your hair after lunch, my lad," he said. "It's full of dirt and straw. Why didn't you brush it when you washed your hands?" Correctly assuming this to be rhetoric, I let him run on while I munched at my salad. Lunch over, however, he was adamant, and I reluctantly went out to wash my hair at the kitchen sink. The colonel's refurbishing had stopped short of a bathroom. I did not like that kitchen one bit. It felt decidedly unfriendly. I liked it much less when I had screwed my eyes shut and started to apply the soft soap to my scalp prior to working up a lather. I have read somewhere, probably as an alternative to propounding some sexual situation, that one is most vulnerable when pulling a shirt over one's head. Since this is not a modern novel, I can leave those aforementioned alternatives and counter-propose that one is truly most vulnerable when soaping one's hair. For I knew that there was something in the room behind me, and that it had no good intent. Stupidly, I tried to open my eyes, and experienced a stinging blindness as the lather ran into them. Had I seen anything in that instant of vision, or hadn't I? Was there a shape at the table behind me? I reached out gropingly for the flannel, which I had placed on the draining rack, to wipe my eyes clear, but instead caught hold of what I thought at first was a section of the cucumber we had for lunch. It was cold and moist at one end, with a rather rubbery skin. Then I changed my mind and screamed, for I found fingers of the same texture at the other end of it. Eyes still smarting appallingly, and now in a blind panic, I ran to where I thought the door was, only to collide with the easy-work dresser, bruising myself badly on the hip and sending glassware and pottery flying. I fell to the floor shouting, or more truthfully, screaming, for my father, only too conscious that I was helplessly at the mercy of whatever else was in the room. In that instant, I heard my father's running step burst into the kitchen, and, in a typical burst of profanity, as he scooped me up, kicking aside the shambles I had made, and ran us both outside. He plunged my head into the water butt to clear the soap, then drove me quickly to Rodding's. The rest of the day is a bit of a blur. I know a doctor came, and I was giving a sleeping draught. Once or twice, I woke from a daze, aware that there was a footman or someone else in the room keeping me company. It was not until months later that my father told me he had seen a figure with a face like an empty walnut shell, across which flame flickered, bending over me as I lay supine in an agony of terror on the kitchen floor. His scornful derision of the haunting had evaporated instantly. In fact, he was now rather pugnacious in his assertion, and much aggravated by the Methodist and Anglican ministers he saw about the matter. Whatever their professional differences, they were united in refusing to visit the cottage, not wanting to lend countenance to such superstition. Above all, Dad could not understand why he had seen nothing until then. One tenable theory I've heard is that the presence of a pubescent child is an effective catalyst. My fright and his was enough for the colonel, who had the cottage shut up and bolted. It was then left to its strange occupant until he remembered that old Bob had been a Roman. As a long shot, and with some swallowing of pride, the colonel sought out the nearest Catholic priest and recounted the happenings to him. Seemingly, this middle-aged priest was not so inclined to pooh-pooh the story and actually visited the cottage to hold some sort of service, a short communion celebration, I think. Whatever he did, it was effective, and the revenant was seen no more. I have since become aware of two curious aspects which may, or may not, bear on the matter. The first was that although the cottage was dusty at the time of this Father O'Connor's visitation, there was no sign whatsoever of any insect or rodent life. The second was that in the course of the normal 5-year routine of replanting the colonel's herbaceous border, a forked prong pierced and lifted the joke coffin. It was, of course, much dirtied and beginning to rot, but it was also empty. For my part, I was puzzled as to why old Bob should return so queerly and behave so malevolently to us who had been his friends, in a manner of speaking. It worried me for many years. In fact, until I met that same old Catholic priest for the first time in a different part of the country. Our talk got on to antiquities. I mentioned where I was living, and we soon made the connections and talked long about Rodding's and the crossing house. I remember one of his remarks, apropos his companion's hay fever in particular, people having different allergies today, he remarked, through a cloud of pipe smoke, where once they saw ghosts, they now have hay fever. It's much the same, really. My asking him about old Bob clearly surprised him, however. My dear chap, he said, that was nothing to do with the revenant. It was simply that in excavating for his new road, the colonel's workmen had cut across an ancient tumulus. Folklore would have it that a most unpleasant creature called a Barovian dwells there and is easily enraged. Other authorities aver that there's an elemental or earth gas that produces strange effects. Whatever the supposition, the fact was that the house had been invaded by such an enraged being, just as some people are sensitive to pollen, blossom, or even, he smiled, their marriage partners. So some of the occupants of the cottage saw the form the thing had assumed, perhaps even borrowing from the molecules of that old cottager who had once lived there and occupied a certain arrangement in the interior space. Others simply felt oppressed and saw nothing at all. At any rate, he concluded briskly, it was certainly only a matter of a minor devil and easily dealt with. The weakest of Christian belief would have sufficed to shut the door, as it clearly did with your father, until your intervention. Well, there it is. Make of it what you will. All I can add is that the cottage has since been modernized further, and a bathroom added. In fact, my parents are living out their retirement there, which is handy, for my father can easily visit the model railway in the garden, to which I will succeed in due course by virtue of having married the colonel's daughter. It has only left one disquiet with me. I cannot bear to wash my hair when I am alone. If my wife cannot be present, then I head for the nearest barber.